Okay, my interests are broadly in two categories. One is in kinetic theory. Kinetic theory has been around for a long time, and lots of people have been working in this. The basic idea is to somehow try to get a description of a granular flow by drawing an analogy between the particles in the granular flow and the molecules in a molecular gas. And you write down the Boltzmann equation for the granular material, and then do some kind of statistical averaging, get macroscopic equations, and then try to solve them. And this has been on for a long time, but there's also been a lot of criticism of this approach for a long time. For one thing, it makes use of something called the molecular chaos approximation, which is not really applicable as the flow becomes more and more dense, because there is correlated motion between particles. And it's also not so even though the constitutive relations are derived and they are used, it's not clear that it's going to be applicable as you go to very dense systems. And the other problem is that in a gra okay, when you write down constitutive equations, you should write them only for what are called conserved or slow variables, that is, variables that are conserved in an interaction between particles, because those variables don't decay in a homogeneous system. So the rate of decay goes as some power of the wave number. And but typically in a granular flow, you write down mass, momentum, energy equations, even though energy is, strictly speaking, a non-conserved variable. It's actually dissipated. And so these kinds of issues are the kinds of things that I address, trying to see to what extent does molecular chaos approximation make a difference in a granular flow as compared to in a classical fluid. In a classical fluid, you know that if you write down the conservation equations and then derive constitutive relations, at the leading order you get the Euler equations, which contain just the pressure for the stress tensor, and then the next order you get the Navier-Stokes, and then the next order you get the Burnett, and so on.
What was the last? Sorry?
Burnett.
Oh, Burnett.
Yeah. Okay. But in a real fluid, it turns out that the Burnett coefficients are infinite because of correlated motion between particles, and they don't decay. So we've been trying to see, does the same thing hold for granular materials, and how you'd go about deriving systematic constitutive relations, and also trying to see how you can improve the molecular chaos approximation by including these correlated collisions in particles, and what is the consequence of energy being a non-conserved mode in granular materials? It turns out that there is an additional length scale apart from the microscopic scale and the macro scales. And this length scale has to do with the length over which energy can be conducted in the medium. So typically, in elastic fluid, this length scale is infinite because energy is conserved. Okay? Whereas in a dissipative medium, this length scale is not infinite. It goes as the ratio of the mean free path and 1 minus e power half, where e is the coefficient of restitution.
I couldn't hear that. I'm sorry.
Okay. So when conduction and dissipation are of the same magnitude, okay, in a fluid, you would expect that there is a length scale that comes out of this. Okay, so for example, if you had some kind of a boundary wherein there was some, the easiest analogy is with the concentration field. So you have some source of concentration at the bottom, okay, and then there is some kind of a reaction going on here, so that you have minus Ra is equal to, okay, and there's a species that is diffusing in. Okay. Now, if there were no reaction, then the species would diffuse in by ordinary diffusion. Okay. But if there is a reaction going on, right, there's going to be a length scale over which this species is going to be confined, at which rate the consumption due to reaction is going to be equal to the rate at which you're diffusing in. Okay. And that length scale is going to be determined by a balance between diffusion and reaction. Okay. A similar thing happens for energy in dissipative systems. Energy is diffusing in from the boundaries, but it's also getting dissipated, okay, due to energy dissipation. And there's a length scale that corresponds to that. Okay?
Will that be exponential?
It'll be exponential, yeah, okay. And there will be a length scale corresponding to that, okay. For a system of inelastic particles, okay, this conduction length will go as the mean free path divided by 1 minus e power half, okay, where e is the coefficient of restitution. So over this length scale, you have to treat energy as a conserved variable. When you go to much larger scales, you treat energy as a non-conserved variable. Okay? And how does this interference of these two length scales affect the dynamic of the system? Okay. So those kinds of issues are what I deal with. Okay.
Is
the mean free path, okay. Or the particle diameter for very dense systems. Okay. And the sort of other issues, other area that I've been working in is what is called statistical geometry. Okay. So in typical thermal systems, we're used to defining everything in terms of equipartition of energy. Okay, so that's the fundamental postulate. Okay, in dissipative systems, you cannot do that. Okay, so one area that I've been trying to look at is to try to see for a dissipative or a conservative system, right, can I get properties such as, let's say I just took a hard disk or a hard sphere system. Okay, can I get thermodynamic properties such as the equation of state, entropy, and so on, just based upon configurations, okay, without any reference to the fundamental equipartition of energy? Okay, and so this sort of relates several concepts. One is what is usually known as the free volume, okay, but which is not clearly defined usually, to entropy. And try to relate that to what is called measures of disorder. Okay, where entropy is now a sort of thermodynamic entropy. And the way we do that, we define free volume sort of unambiguously by doing a Voronoi tessellation on these systems. Okay. And if we take the Voronoi volume and subtract out the minimum volume, you get a free volume distribution. We find that the free volume distributions follow a gamma distribution to a very good approximation. Okay, it's not exact, but it does. And if you define an entropy based upon that gamma distribution, you get a simple relation between that and the thermodynamic entropy. Okay. And it turns out that these distributions also give you some measure of disorder. When you go to dense random packed states, you find that to a very good approximation, this expression for entropy is extremized. Okay, so that's briefly what I do.
That gamma distribution result, that is also obtained for Voronoi tessellations of random points.
Yeah, there it's exact.
I find it a little bit surprising that a system which is in some sense packed has statistics similar to a spatial.
Okay, Yeah, I'll show you the results. Yeah. Okay, I have no theoretical insight on that. I just did simulations and we sort of found that out. So. Okay. And I mean, there are issues with simulations. Someone was mentioning Torquato simulations the other day. Similar issues are there here in that when you try to go to dense random packed systems, your algorithms always sort of tend towards frozen structures, that is crystallized structures, and you have to figure out ways to get out of that. Okay, so.
You can pass John the microphone.
You understand that you're always under surveillance.
Oh, is that okay? I wondered why this was necessary. But.
We can take steps to make sure it's all off if anyone is sensitive.
I have nothing to hide.
Well, people commonly think that the world of large corporations is Orwellian, but universities are far more so.
Yes.
We have to discuss the facilities in which you tend that.
Okay, so I guess I fit into this program under the phrase geophysical applications of granular materials. And I guess I'll start with a little bit of background. So my background is engineering and solid mechanics, but I've always been interested in problems related to geophysics, so generally in the area of fracture and earthquake mechanics and coupling of fluid flow with deformation. So I think there are two things that I've recently been interested in that relate to granular materials. The first is I would say compaction localization in sandstones. Or other porous rocks. And to explain this, sort of show you the canonical rock test, which is to take a cylinder of rock and put some lateral pressure on it, and then increase the axial stress on it. And if the rock is, initially it more or less deforms homogeneously, okay? If it's a low porosity rock, meaning that the porosity is less than about a couple percent, eventually this more or less homogeneous pattern gives way to a sort of localized shearing in the fault like so, okay? And that typically occurs somewhere if you were to plot the load versus end displacement somewhere in this range. Recently, people have found that in porous rocks that some...
John, is that shear banding, isn't that actually more characteristic of a uniaxial compressive test? When you describe it as if you were loading it home. Isotropically,
no, it's not loaded isotropically. This stress is typically greater than these, but normally these tests are done with lateral confinement too. Yeah. So recently, people have found that in porous rocks, there's another mode that happens. Again, these initially it tends to be more or less homogeneous. But then at some point, a band forms perpendicular to the maximum load, which seems like an odd thing, but it's been found in a number of experiments, and it's also been observed in the field. So geologists go out and they find these things, and by observing markers that cross the band and the absence of offset, they conclude that these things have formed basically by compaction localization.
This is an entirely different phenomenon occurring on a different time scale from pressure solution.
Yes, yes. Well, we don't know how fast it happens in the field, but in the lab it happens relatively fast. In the micro graphs show that it's entirely a mechanical phenomenon, mostly associated, well, this again is part of the controversy. In the lab, it tends to be associated with grain crushing. In the field, they don't see that so often. It's often just the grains become disaggregated, but the reduction of, and sometimes fractured, but not crushed. Okay, so, the porosity in these bands is typically half that in the surrounding material. So the starting porosity may be 20% and in the bands 10%. Okay, so one thing relates, why do these things happen? Okay, there's been a certain amount of success in describing that using a kind of bifurcation theory that was used for shear bands and relating the behavior of the rock to certain, the formation of these bands to certain kinds of inelastic behavior, constitutive relations for these kinds of rocks. What's become a more pressing issue is that people see these in various forms in the lab. In some cases, they see them, they start at the ends, and they come in as a front. And so they actually, it's sort of a kinematic wave that comes in from the ends, leaves the rock entirely compacted without any evidence of actual banding. In other cases, they see bands that also start at the end, but leave relatively uncompacted material behind. And then there are yet other experiments where people drill into a cube of rock that's been stressed, and they see these things propagate out from the hole in the rock. All these are somewhat different from what happens in the field. So there's a real question of how do these things propagate either laterally or extend in their own plane. In the field, they're tens of meters long and still very narrow. Maybe that's enough said about that item for the time being. Okay, and then the other area is sort of mechanics of earthquake fault zones. Fault zones. Oops. Okay, and here specifically, my interests are sort of the coupling with fluid and heat. Okay, so if you go back to this picture here, this might be a sort of rudimentary model of what happens in an earthquake fault when you go out and look at it in the field. But within this sort of mashed up zone, there's a variety of structures. And one of the things we've been looking at is that how does the actual slip localize within this zone. Okay, one of the proposals has been that that's related to the coupling of heat and fluid flow with the mechanics. Let me see, again, to try and explain this in sort of a simple way, if you just think of a spring and a slider, and so there's some resistive friction here. There's been a lot of work that shows that this typically is a function of the slip rate and a state variable that evolves. And if you're pulling this at some fixed velocity, which here you could think of as the relative motion of California relative to the Pacific. So this is a couple centimeters per year. And this is also proportional to, say, a normal stress minus the pore pressure. Okay, so the friction coefficient. Okay, so depending on the behavior of this thing, this block may move stably or unstably. That is, if you pull this slowly at some fixed rate, depending on the behavior of this thing, the block will jump ahead at certain points, be an earthquake. And the resistance to shearing is decreased by an increase in pore pressure. Okay, and the pore pressure can be changed by heat generated by frictional shearing. So these two things couple in to affect the mechanical behavior of this block. And in continuum kind of calculations, they also will affect how this becomes localized in a narrow zone.
what is theta?
So the theta is a state variable that there's a lot of evidence from, mostly from experiments, that the friction in rocks depends on the rate of sliding, but also on a state variable that basically describes the state of the surface and the asperities that are in contact. So it's a phenomenological, sort of very crude, but seems to be accurate description of the state of the surface.
History dependent variable, right?
Yeah. So typically, the state variable evolves in some way that's people use.
There's a finite memory.
Yes.
It's not,
that's right.
Not history dependent in a stained glass way where you remember all these things that happened in the past.
Yeah, it's a fading memory in a sense. So there's a certain slip distance over which it remembers the past history, and once you're beyond that, it doesn't. Enough said for now, or?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Dean, this may seem a bit of an ambush, but you didn't get a chance before.
This is just a monologue.
Yeah. Oh yeah, there you go.
There we go. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a lot of replacements. That's how I got into the replacement.
Okay, do you need so, this too, or are you?
Do you have to have that? Yes. You want me to have
thank you.
All right, deal. So I'm a local, and I'm Jean Carlson. I was here last week. I was left off the list. Part of the problem with being a local is that, you know, you still have all your stuff here, your students and committees and activities, so I run around a lot. Okay, so I think we're doing a lot of different kinds of things that touch on different parts of the granular problem, and I think maybe the best thing for me to tell you is kind of how I got into this and just a little bit of an overview of what we're doing. We have a bunch of stuff that we're going to do with various parts of this, hopefully in the next couple of weeks for the program. So one thing that people in my group wanted me to remind you is that tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and I'm not sure where. Do you have, yeah, because it's not on the schedule. But last week on Wednesday, we went through and made this whole list of different topics we ought to discuss. And one of the areas that my group works in has to do with kind of boundary layer instabilities. And it just happened that some of the relevant people would be here tomorrow. So we're going to have like an open group meeting and discuss this work. And I asked a friend of mine who's done the fluids version of this, who's a control theorist, to talk about that in kind of a review way. And then we'll talk about, hopefully, Jim Langer will come and talk a little bit about the constitutive laws that we've been studying for amorphous solids and granular materials. And then the two students who've been working on looking at instabilities in the constitutive laws and also fluids coupled to elastic boundaries. We'll talk about tomorrow. So there's an open
KITP
group meeting. Yeah, so the KITP version doesn't show up. Yeah.
Places because KITP is
right.
Ripping off our blog.
Yeah.
Into their schedule. And you're right.
Anyway, just so you know, this is tomorrow and it's going to be, somebody's going to come and give a very general talk about the fluids case. And I know, you know, my student Lisa, who's been to a bunch of these things, is going to talk a little bit. And then I have a student, Eric, who's really excellent, works on earthquakes, a lot of the same stuff. He's going to talk a little bit about that stuff, too. And Jim Langer, too.
To confirm,
so, yes, 1 o'clock
tomorrow here.
In this room. Okay,
is
that's
on
what I'm
the version of the schedule in
okay.
The blog.
Okay, and then the other thing we had talked about, I don't know if that's going to happen, but next Monday at 1:30, we were going to try to get together a bunch of people that do granular simulations. So next Monday, which has got to be the 11th, this is not just us, but this is the simulations. And another one of my students who's doing a lot of stuff on granular material simulations, Greg Lowes, who's been at a bunch of these meetings, is going to talk about the things he's been doing. We've been using simulations as a way to try to...
1:30 or 11:30?
I'm sorry, 1:30, yeah. So after, the idea was that we do this after the Blackboard seminar. That we have, do we know that for sure? Did you talk to Greg or email Greg?
No.
Yeah, so Greg is away this week, unfortunately. And so is Craig Maloney, who's the person doing simulations in the Langer group. And both of them really wanted to be part of this. So we're going to try to do this while she's in town and there in town.
Do we have a room for this yet?
No. I mean, it's not very, you know, it's mostly that we had this mention last week.
I'm not sure about the time yet. Sorry.
Yeah.
But it's Monday in a week, so.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not right away. I mean, it's coming later.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Right. And then the other.
It's Monday, 11 April, 1:30 p.m., simulations of.
This is the hope, okay? And I'm just putting these things down because. We might as well get them all down. And I noticed this wasn't in the schedule, and my student was worried about it. So this should be fun, because this is going to involve control theory people and fluids. So it's a little bit, it's not very tightly focused, and the STZ Langer stuff. What?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Do you mind this? I mean, these are discussions we would have anyway, but I think it would be very interesting to have people in the program. Give us some feedback.
Fine, but I'm putting it on the internet.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, and then the other thing that I suggested to you as a possibility, if this goes well, is the Wednesday, not of this week, because actually I'm out of town, but the following Wednesday, you had asked me to talk about friction and control. And so the friction and control people can do, so let's say 13/20. So that is Wednesday, 1 o'clock, 4:20. Okay, good job. Anyway, this comes out of looking at some of these different constitutive laws and how they enter into control of, machine kind of control. Okay, so these are three things that'll be much more complete than what I'm going to say now. So I got into all of this because I. Long ago, started working when I was a postdoc here on earthquake dynamics, models of earthquake dynamics. And I came at it sort of naively at a time when people in physics were very interested in simple models that produced sort of broad distributions of events. And so Jim Langer and I started working on a very simple block and spring model, like what you drew, except with lots of masses. And driven, by some loading process at some slow velocity. And the key nonlinear element sitting in this model is some friction law that has to do with the static friction threshold subject to shear, and then the dynamic friction when it starts to slide. And we just, at the time, put in a very simple friction law that was a function just of the slip rate, and found that this simple model could produce broad distributions of events with certain features that were similar to Gutenberg-Richter like statistics. But came quickly to our attention, and we were told by many people in the geophysical community that this is really a very naive assumption about the friction. And so we moved into one of the directions that I moved shortly after doing this was to look more at constitutive laws for friction. So this is still part of the program that my group has been interested in. One of the things that has been used extensively in the rock mechanics community is this Dietrich-Ruina law. But that doesn't work for everything. So I think one of the interesting things to me, actually, that Thomas brought up during his talk yesterday is the statement that constitutive laws work pretty well. And actually, my experience in having worked in some of these other fields is that constitutive laws actually don't work very well. And one of the big problems that people in...
Did I say that?
You said that. You said, like, oh, all these people have constitutive laws that work well enough for things like chute flow. So I think you said the engineers are pretty good at developing constitutive laws.
Right.
And my experience...
The constitutive laws tend to be wrong, but they're tend to be compensating errors.
Right. So my my experience with constitutive laws is that they're wrong, and that one way in which they're wrong is that they're often really fail to be predictive. And for you, so a lot of times the way that the engineers have built their constitutive laws is because they want to have a, you know, a kind of reproducible flow, and so they make a measurement so they know sort of what on average some resistive force is going to be. But it's not easy in this business to fit your laws to one experiment and then, you know, extend them to another. So one of my very productive interactions with people in the engineering community have been trying to, you know, to find some constitutive laws that we can fit on one experiment and then make a prediction about another experiment. So I think that it's interesting, and we're looking at a lot of different experiments. The other thing is trying to, you know, this Dietrich-Ruina law that you wrote down is one that is really pervasive in the earthquakes and rock mechanics community, but it's clearly not the only constitutive law. And so we wound up looking at not just, you know, sort of for earthquakes, but also for other kinds of experiments like boundary lubrication. And it turns out that we have a great experimental group here, Jacob Israelich-Vili's group, that we've worked closely with in terms of trying to develop constitutive laws for this boundary lubricant interface, which is a very tiny but very clean experimental system with just a few atomic layers of lubricant in between. So this is another case. And another case is, you know, that we're looking at is granular materials. So there's just a whole bunch of, you know, interesting things about trying to compare the kinds of constitutive laws, come up with reasonable microscopic descriptions, and see how and whether and when they matter for all kinds of different processes, whether it be, you know, in earthquake simulations, really, you know, or whether it be, you know, as sort of in the context of control. So one of the things we're interested in is developing these kinds of constitutive laws, studying their properties, and trying to connect them up with experiments in these different cases. And we hope to move further in this during the program. So we've been looking at that. So another thing that, So I think one of the other things that is interesting with this earthquakes problem is we definitely have been kind of took a step back to look at experiments. We don't do experiments, but we look at experiments and work closely with some experimental groups. Look at simulations. So we have done things like MD simulations of amorphous materials or lubricants. Also, what Greg is doing now is contact dynamic simulations of granular materials. And a big part of what Greg is doing here is trying to use these contact dynamic simulations as a way to test constitutive laws. So do an experiment in one geometry and see whether or not the parameters that you fit to a constitutive law for that geometry work when you do another geometry with a granular simulation. So that's the kind of thing you'd like to do experimentally. You'd like to have that work, but he's doing it both looking at the microscopic, you know, rearrangements that motivate the constitutive laws in the first place, but also testing them in different regimes. And then another thing we do is we go all the way back to now, we move from this to something that's a much more you know, realistic simulation scenario where we've got, you know, a 3D continuum elastic, vector elasticity code, where we're looking at simulations. Again, there's an embedded interface, goes down in the ground. You don't know really what the earthquake, you know, friction laws are. So we've been looking at how do different assumptions about what these friction laws might be affect the dynamics that you see in a 3D continuum case. And we also doing all kinds of things that involve the impact of, you know, the dynamics interacting with heterogeneities too, which turns out to have some really interesting effects. And then there's a whole series of experiments that you can try to link up with that kind of thing too. So we're very interested in you know, again, came our history of this came out of thinking about the earthquakes, but it took us all the way down to, you know, microscopic atomic scale studies. And one thing about this actually is that we've got really a program here at UCSB. It was a sponsored by the Keck program, but it's an interdisciplinary studies in what is it? Interdisciplinary science. Basically, it's seismology and materials physics. So people that were involved in this were David Pine, who's here, gave us a talk last week. Jacob Israelishvili, who also should be somebody that maybe comes and gives us a talk sometime. Jim Langer and myself, and also Ralph Archuleta. And he's interested, you know, he does the seismology side. So it's really been a issue of connecting scales, which is the thing that Thomas mentioned. And it's been a really, in his talk yesterday also, it's been a really productive interaction with trying to think all the way from atomic scale simulations with Jim's group and my group have been doing through constitutive laws and then their impact at the largest scales with an experimental component. So one of the things that David's work relates to are things like liquefaction, you know, when you shake things, and does the state of there are constitutive laws not just for the friction in a fault, but also for what happens when these elastic waves propagate through, you know, and come and shake your home. And so one of the interesting things that got him involved in this was thinking about, you know, what about those constitutive laws? And so one of the people that I think is extremely useful in this also for me as a resource person for the last, you know, 17 years or something is Ralph Archuleta, because he's, you know, very much connected also with, you know, what are the assumptions that go into these dynamical models. And so he's been a real help in terms of connecting up the things that we do with that. Okay, so this is kind of half of what my group is about. The other half of my group does something called complex systems. And this is something that really grows out of, for me, you know, a kind of statistical physics background. And, you know, physicists have had a lot of ideas that have come into the study of complex systems. And by complex systems, I basically mean, you know, there's so many things, geophysical, ecosystems, you know, a whole, you know, biological systems, social, technological systems. And I think there's all kinds of themes that people that try to model large systems across a broad range of disciplines talk about. And the question is, you know, is this gobbledygook or is this something that's useful for the study of these things? And so I think we've been trying to do useful things. And one of the things that I've been working on a lot lately has been trying to bring together a perspective that comes out of physics, which is, you know, the simple models and looking for ways to identify general mechanisms from simple descriptions, and a picture that comes more out of engineering and biology, which is to say that systems are, you know, maybe complicated internally, but are behave more regularly in terms of their external behavior. And so a big concept that comes out of the engineering side, it has to do with robustness of complex systems. And by robustness, what I mean here is robustness to variations in the environment. So, so to external disturbance. So one of the things that this whole field is very interested in are things like avalanches and cascading failures, which obviously have their analogs in granular materials and geophysical systems. So, you know, why is a, you know, why does such a small perturbation cascade throughout the system and give rise to broad distribution of sizes of events? Things like that. I could spend a lot of time talking about this, but I'm just trying to give you a flavor of it. And what I've been doing recently has been really looking at robustness in these systems, in particular robustness fragility trade-offs. So big theme is robust yet fragile. So turns out that if you want to make your system more robust to something, it often becomes more fragile to something else. And so we're really interested in these trade-offs and trying to understand them. So that's part of my questions about things like you do this preparation of something and it's very robust in a certain way. Is there another way you could perturb it that might be very sensitive to? So I'm interested, in this sort of robust yet fragile, why are our systems behave so predictably so much of the time, and yet a small perturbation can initiate some large cascading failure? Now, why does this, how does this fit into the granular side? Well, I think one of the things that is a tool for talking about robustness, or what are the toolkits for talking about robustness in engineering? A lot of that comes out of control theory or control and dynamical systems theory. And there's this whole field of robust control theory, which is really a systems theory that has to do with thinking about systems more in terms of their input-output characteristics. So it's got a more of a mathematical framework of thinking about how a system behaves as a consequence to how you drive it and what you want to measure. And they've got some systematic tools for that. They're very interested in feedback. So feedback, thinking about feedback in systematic ways, thinking about things like transients and amplification of transients. As well. So many of these tools are just tools people use in engineering. They've used engineering fluid mechanics a lot. And the question is, can they come and help us in terms of looking at transient phenomena in geophysical systems or transient phenomena in other kinds of systems? And I think one of the things we can really bring to this community too is this notion of physically based models for things like frictional instabilities. And so it's sometimes through these kinds of collaborations that we're getting some interesting synergistic interactions right away. So the projects that are coming out that are related to this program that have this flavor to them is this one. The boundary layer instabilities in fluids is really based on a control theoretic framework which has been used to study instabilities of fluids in shear flow, which have to do with a kind of pseudo-spectral analysis which amplifies small inhalant jets on the boundary and provides very nice descriptions of turbulent flows. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, does that occur in constitutive relations that have been that we're looking at for frictional instabilities in granular materials and amorphous systems? And then the other one is, another one has to do with looking at this problem of friction and control. And here, a lot of what, people that are trying to build things, whether it be MEMS devices or, controllers for automobile, automatic braking systems and so on, you need a controller that will make it possible to position your device accurately or control the speed well. And if you're in a regime where the speed you want to be at would be stick slip, right? You don't want stick slip. You want to go constantly at that speed. So you've got to put in some sort of mechanical adjustment along the way that actually gives you the stable sliding and lets you slow smoothly as opposed to undergo these various instabilities. Turns out in building micro mechanical devices, it's the friction models that are really their problem right now. And I think they don't know what's a good friction model. And so what we're hoping to do is bring our sort of physics-based understanding, for what it is at the moment, which is incomplete, as we all know, but what kind of constitutive laws might be, you know, appropriate for different control or in control situations. We're also just trying to gather this literature of friction models, which sits in so many different fields, and you know, provide a more common framework for it, and then try to use these different models in terms of different control situations. And that's something that has a, we're working, again, with experimental groups and with people who unfortunately aren't here right now, but that are, that have used the engineering constitutive laws and are very excited about some of the things that the physics ones have in them for, because they know that physically things like keeping things in contact, they tend to, you know, strengthen over time, but they haven't been in the constitutive laws that are used in this, in that particular community. Okay, that's what we're doing.
Fair enough.
Okay.